Welcome to Pencils Down, a Finalis podcast. This is a show for listeners wanting to learn more about the ins and outs of the private securities brokerage landscape. Each episode will feature insightful conversations with the world's leading investment bankers, placement agents, capital providers, startup CEOs, and more. And with that, let's get into the show. All right. Matthew Epstein, thanks so much for joining us here on the Pencils Down podcast.
You are more than welcome. Very excited. Happy to be here.
I usually like to start by asking our guests to share a little bit about their backgrounds and their eventual paths into investment banking. I couldn't help but noticing that, similar to me, you also had a stint in law before finding yourself into this industry. And I'm just genuinely very curious. Would love to learn a little bit more about your career path.
Yeah, I like to joke I'm a failed lawyer. So I actually practiced as a lawyer, and not to malign the legal career, I actually think it was great unintentional training for being a banker. I mean that in all honesty. I think the great thing about law is it sort of forces this analytical rigor. You know, there's this concept in law called relevance. If something's relevant, you got to address it. And so it sort of teaches you that, you know, to sort of really look at the issues in front of you, whatever they might be, and deal with them, even if they don't fit into some preconceived or nice, pretty array, shall we say. But anyways, I actually practice as a M&A lawyer and, you know, at a leading a firm here in New York. But it actually made me want to be more involved in the transaction. So, you know, lawyers play a critical role, but, you know, I was being given deals that in some cases, you know, the principals have been talking about for years, and I wanted to play a more integral role in sort of setting those deals up. And so that's what took me into banking, I'm embarrassed to say, you know, more than 20 years ago.
And tell me a little bit about that transition. So, you know, kind of taking the leap of faith from, I believe you were at Wachtell, a little known law firm in New York.
Little known law firm.
So kind of specifically, just curious, you know, what were the catalyzing events for you that led you to ultimately take that leap?
Yeah. So as I said, you know, I worked, it was, you know, very interesting, worked on a lot of large deals, but I wanted to feel I was on the front end of the funnel, shall we say, more on the, call it the middle or maybe the back end of the funnel. So, you know, Wachtell's not a bad platform. So you tell people you're interested in joining investment banking, they interview you. I ended up joining Lehman. To a large extent, I felt the culture felt good. It felt sort of, you know, just sort of suited to my personality, like the joke, Lehman, you know, brothers, may they rest in peace now. And the transition was, you know, in some ways difficult, in some ways it wasn't. You know, if you're going to the business, you're going to work hard. And I really worked hard. And to be a little bit immodest, I was a math geek in high school. So I didn't find the mathematics or the analytics of the business difficult. But to be quite honest, I, you know, had to learn accounting and all those other things sort of on the job. And I will not pretend for a moment that was easy. But, you know, this was back in the 90s. You know, maybe the business is a little more, was a little more accommodating then in some regards. In other regards, it was sort of, you know, the crazy stories of managing directors flinging staplers at people's heads. Back then, at least, were true. So it was a bit of a grind, but I enjoyed it. I did well, you know, was sort of fell into the fig group at Lehman. And out of that, I fell into fintech, or got a taste of it. I got, you know, sort of tapped on the shoulder and asked to sort of look at some investments for the firm, which I found, you know, interesting. This is back in the late 90s, and these are early startups, and the world's changing. A group of senior bankers I worked with did a group trade, as it's called, from Lehman to UBS. They asked me to come with them, and I said, yeah, but I don't want to do this balance sheet bank stuff anymore. I want to do this weird fintech stuff, to which they said, fine, and here I am, you know, 20-odd years later.
I mean, it's fascinating because, of course, at the time that you were at Lehman, I'm quite confident fintech wasn't even a term that was being used in the lexicon. And so tell me a little bit about, you know, some of those early transactions that you worked on that really sparked that interest in you to focus on the fintech sector. What was it about the fintech space in particular that got you excited?
There's a couple of things. I mean, there was some of the people listening to this podcast may remember this name. There's a firm called Daytech, which provided a technology platform for day trading. as it was called back then. I guess you would now call it, you know, proprietary trading, I guess is how they call it. Doesn't, that term is no longer used much. What was interesting is it was a relatively small company that had really sort of come from nowhere and grown. We ended up passing on the deal because we just couldn't get comfortable on some background check information on the CEO. But one of the major private equity firms invested in it and did great. Silverlink actually invested in, had a very good return. But just seeing that, you know, the ability to build a new business model relatively quickly. The other thing that was interesting is related to that, there was a company that was, it was called the Island ECN. This is early in the alternative trading venues. And they came in one day and I was part of the team that was asked to come in and look, and they showed on their own browser real-time quotes that were available to the public. Is, you know, here's actually the bid-ask spread in equities. And to me, that was really eye-opening. I said, if, you know, if anybody can see this, you know, it's going to completely change the way in which people think about equity trading and equity execution. And sure enough, the markets look dramatically different now than they did in the late 90s. And it was seeing in real time the ability for that new technology to change so dramatically a business that to a large extent, you know, was at that point, you know, other than NASDAQ, and that was a new electronic platform, but had been around for a long time. New York Stock Exchange, the other exchanges, you know, most of the trading was done in open outcry on the floor of the exchanges. Heavily technology intermediated, so, you know, so I'm not pretending it was sort of from horse and buggy overnight, but you know, there is now very little trading done on any venues on, you know, physically on the floor anywhere in the world. And it was just sort of seeing the potential for that technology change that sort of made me want to be part of it or at least be involved in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like that sector focus has really become, you know, a defining characteristic of your career, because if you then fast forward 20 years from the moment that you entered at Lehman, you took probably the most significant leap of faith of all, which really was to leave a larger boutique, DC Advisory, to form your own boutique investment bank, New Bold Partners. Tell me a little bit about that transition and, you know, what there again might have been the catalyzing events or realizations that led you to want to start your own platform.
I would like to say it was all part of some brilliant grandmaster plan, but in honesty, there's definitely a big element of just dumb luck. But very good luck. I was unhappy at my prior firm, not to speak ill of them, but it just, I was unhappy with the firm and was actively looking to join another firm and was very close in a series of discussions. You know, there was like the global head of TMT for a big international bank was supposed to fly in from London. We were supposed to interview the day New York shut down from COVID. And in a weird way, thankfully, because of COVID, those conversations stopped. And then the second thing that COVID showed me was, you know, there was this brief period, as we should recall, early in 2020, everything just sort of stopped for about 6 or 7 or 8 weeks. And then everything sort of started to come back and deals continued and people talked about new deals. And it was clearly there was capital put to work. And, you know, as the year progressed, my dissatisfaction with my current firm didn't change. I started realizing, yeah, I can't get on a plane. I can't go to a hotel. I can't take you out for dinner, but I can still do business. And I had this realization, and I was doing business. And it was sort of the catalyst to say, you know what, you know, if not now, when, right? Why don't I just try and go do this on my own? And clients were incredibly supportive. And, you know, very quickly, you know, within a few weeks of leaving DC, had several mandates. Even in that stub year of 2020, it was, right. You know, my standalone operation was profitable. It's been, you know, not to brag, but to brag a little bit, quite profitable since I've gone out on my own. And, you know, it was a bit of taking that leap of faith, but it was, to be quite honest, dumb luck. I mean, but for COVID, I'm highly sure I would have joined another firm. And so I keep saying, using the word lucky, but there definitely was more than a little bit of that in it. But, you know, you sort of, there's a phrase a friend of mine or many people use, you know, there's being lucky, but also sort of seizing it when it comes along. And so maybe I'll give myself a little bit of credit for that and having just sort of the gumption to sort of up and do it. I mean, the name New Bold actually is funny. I formed the company when I was up in northern Wisconsin. So we have a lake house. Actually, my grandfather bought it way in the deep northern Wisconsin. If, you know, people know where Rhinelander or Minocqua is. We're sort of equal distance from these two little towns. And it's not a town. The nearest incorporated entity is called New Bold. And so I turned to my wife and said, you know, I'm going to do this. I have to come up with a name for a company. I said, what do you think about New Bold? And she said, sounds good. Go for it. And I checked the URL, of course, and found that nobody owned it. So,
well, that is the critical element. You have to check the URL. That's it's so funny. That's very much the case with the ultimate naming of Finalis. But, you know, what's interesting there is, in the same way that COVID created this opportunity for you, it also presented a new set of challenges. I mean, investment banking is such a human relationship driven business. And I think COVID really put the industry in a place where it had to almost reinvent to a certain extent how business was going to be done in a fully virtual and remote context. Tell me a little bit about what that experience was like for you, especially in the context of starting up a brand new boutique investment bank, to be forced to effectively launch and scale the enterprise in a fully virtual way.
It's a great question. I mean, continuing sort of the trend of luck, I mean, the one thing that was luck for all of the industry sort of really starting in that latter half of 2020 and deep into 2021, business stayed great, right? We all know that, you know, M&A volumes, you know, continued to go up. IPO market was active. SPACs exploded. You know, certain amount of hangovers going to be suffered from that for probably a few years now. But overall volumes, overall profitability of the business truly exploded. And I benefited from that. And a lot of other bankers did, to be honest. I mean, what it did do is it sort of showed more than anything else that you could do the business to a large extent virtually, right? The way you and I are talking right now. You know, the proliferation of Zoom and other, you know, online video platforms. The business had sort of going a little bit off topic, but if you think about when I joined banking, Excel was a relatively new application. Been around for a few years. There were still some older bankers who insisted on using Lotus for, now I'm really dating myself, Lotus 1-2-3. So technology has sort of been chewing this role through investment banking for years. I remember talking to senior M&A bankers when I was a young banker, and they talked about doing their DCF calculations by hand, right? And you would finish the calculation and they'd hand the results to typists who would type it up on these long books and you would do a version. And so Excel has sort of ushered in this ability for anybody who's good at mathematics to sort of run endless calculations. And the virtual part of the world has allowed anyone, myself, a lot of the, you know, the other firms on the Finalis platform to a large extent, to, you know, build platforms with a much smaller footprint, leveraging a variety of technology. The challenge and the benefit of that is, you know, it sort of throws you back on your existing relationships. So, your good relationships, you can use them. And, you know, I don't have to fly to the West Coast or to London or wherever it is to talk to a client. The challenge is, how do you get new business? And so I think what COVID has done, particularly, you know, the investment banking where it is today, given the big declines in value, is it's sort of breaking the business more into sort of a flow business, for lack of a better word. Investment banking covers a lot of stuff, but businesses that's based upon more of a transactional, higher volume flow kind of businesses, and something that's much more old school investment banking that's really based on trust. And, you know, if you've got a trusted relationship with a client, you know, they're going to transact with you, you're going to transact with them. The challenge has been, you know, how do you expand those relationships? And, you know, I did a transaction on the Finalis platform that you may recall that I was hired by the client. I'd met the number two in the firm previously in person, but, you know, not in a business context, and had only, I hadn't spent a lot of time with him. The CEO, I didn't meet him in person until we had one sort of drafting session before our first management presentation. Everything else was done virtually. And so I think you can develop those relationships of trust in this new virtual environment, but it's, you know, it's a challenge. You've got to find a way to come across authentic. You have to be authentic, but you have to also convey that authentic quality that you can be someone who's trusted. And I think that trend in the business is actually going to continue. Meaning sort of this bifurcation of the business more into more that are transactional flow businesses and more that are old school trust based kind of relationships. The old classic, you know, deep client relationship where the client really trusts you, you're a trusted advisor, a phrase I think is, you know, overused and you know, people aren't, you know, sort of thrown around too much willy-nilly. But I think, you know, that will continue. You know, one's seen that development, you know, with the rise of the boutiques even before COVID. And I think that will only get accelerated.
Yeah. It's interesting because, so totally agree with everything you said. And it's interesting because I also feel that, you know, the norms are shifting in real time and the dust hasn't quite settled post-COVID, but the world hasn't fully reverted to doing business the way business was being done pre-COVID either, right? And so it almost seems as if we're landing in a new normal that includes some degree of virtual, but also some degree of in-person, where perhaps the bar for that in-person interaction is higher, right? Or the criticality of that in-person interaction, it needs to be there in order to justify the trip or the in-person meeting. I wonder if the norms are going to be shifting to a point where you may be able to build and sustain new business relationships without meeting people in person. It's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think there will be a new normal. I think a new normal is beginning to develop. You know, lots of things change. And one of the things that changed for me was also my business model. So because of that realization, look, you couldn't travel. And to be frankly, to this day, you know, if I can avoid traveling, I will continue to avoid traveling. In fact, this is embarrassing to admit, but I'm going to go on my first real business marketing trip since COVID in 2 weeks, which is maybe a shot sign more of my laziness than anything else. But
you love New York City. That's nothing to be ashamed of.
I traveled around New York City with great aggression or great great enjoyment, maybe. But you know, the one thing that did happen as I did Newbold, I did shift the business a little bit unintentionally, but now intentionally. What do I mean by that? You know, when people ask me what is Newbold, I say it's a fintech focused merchant bank that looks to not only advise but invest with clients. And so because of that, I do a disproportionate amount of buy side work, right? You sell a business, you can't invest in it, it's gone. And so I typically will take the approach, look, you know, pay me a fair fee, but I'm going to like to take half of it if it's possible in equity. But the other, and I do that on these sort of retained buy side mandates that I have. The other thing I've done, and I've had some success, is trying to put together transactions outside of an auction process where I know there's an asset to be bought. I would like to own a piece of it. I go find a partner that I think that I can work with. And that element of trust, I know they'll trust me. I can trust them. You know, if you go after an asset outside of a process, you sort of get one shot, right? There, you can't sort of flub it up. The owner of the asset's not going to come back to you a second time. And in those opportunities as well, I look to speak for capital beyond that which my partner can deploy on their own. So the great example of that is bought a business or worked on a transaction for about $1 billion. You know which one I'm talking about. Picked a private equity firm that I'd worked with in the past and had a good relationship of trust with them. They trusted me enough to have hired me on buy-side mandates. We hadn't gotten them done. I'd known them for many years. And I sort of knew I had one shot. And I ended up, because the deal was outsized for their fund and because I brought it to them and they were, you know, generous people, ended up speaking for about 20% of the equity capital for my own investor relations. And being able to do that kind of deal also changes the dynamic. You know, I actually did get a call from more than one private equity firm that I knew not as well as the one I worked with that sort of politely, you know, reamed me out. Why didn't I get the call? And you sort of politely answered, I didn't trust you as much as I trusted the entity I worked with. And that sounds incredibly arrogant, but when it's COVID and a smaller platform said, you sort of want to use the arrows in your quiver, one might say, more effectively or more efficiently. And being able to do a deal like that, we've worked on several more since then, and we have a couple more in the pipeline. It changes the dynamic of your relationship with other people. So, you know, you talk to new potential clients, whether they're asset owners, you know, current asset owners or people who want to buy an asset, and being able to do a transaction like that, they look at you a little bit different, not just as someone who's going to help them get a deal done, but as someone who can bring value added in terms of, you know, getting access to a unique asset. And so, you know, in those circumstances, frankly, people are, you know, willing to talk to you to a greater extent over the phone or over Zoom. You know, they're not as demanding as seeing you in person. You're perceived as bringing a different value added to the transaction if you know what I mean. And I think that's also been a shift. I would have never thought of doing a transaction like that or structuring like that pre-COVID at my old firm. And so that's also another point I'm trying to say about luck, that because of COVID, I had the luck of launching Newbold because Newbold was my own firm. And I wasn't really constrained in any way about how I wanted to go about deals other than, you know, they had to be legal and here with regulatory compliance. And so I knew I had this opportunity, and rather than taking another approach to it, I took this very specific approach to it. And I had the luxury of doing that. So I'm sort of rambling on here a little bit.
What's fascinating there is that what you were looking to solve for, to a certain extent, was, you know, how do you build more trust in a client relationship? Being creative about building that relationship or deepening the ways in which you can deliver value with your clients certainly is one way to do that. And then another way to do that, which occurs to me, is by having a very deep sector expertise. And that's something that you clearly have been able to achieve, and that, you know, on your website, it discusses how Newbold combines this deep fintech industry expertise with a track record of delivering thoughtful and insightful advice. And I wanted to return back to a point that you mentioned a little bit earlier in the podcast regarding this specialization and expertise on fintech. I'd be curious to dig in a little deeper on specifically your firm's experience in the space. And then I have to ask you, reflect also on, you know, what we've seen, you know, in the latter half of 2022, in particular, as it relates to FTX last fall around developments in the crypto space.
No, thanks for the great plug on Newbold. Look, I've been doing this for a long time, and you get to know the sector well. And in the specialization, you know, for instance, we have several retained buy-side mandates where we get, you know, paid a nice, you know, monthly retainer. And the only reason we get those, right, of course, we like taking it because it helps pay the bills and covers the expenses. But people are effectively, they're doing that because of that kind of insights into the market, market dynamics, market trends, who the providers are. And, you know, that is an element that just comes from, you know, having spent an awful long time in the industry. I think you may know, I took, you know, a sabbatical, lucky not smart, I missed the great financial crisis, and went to work for a client, you know, before 2008 hit. I didn't see it coming, and gave a little bit more of the insight from the operational side. And that has definitely helped in terms of, you know, getting hired, but also coming with a very strong point of view. I like to think that I tell people what I would do if I were in their shoes, the owner of the asset, the person looking to buy an asset. And so it's funny, on the back end of last year, you know, maybe to my detriment, my short-term detriment, but I definitely think my long-term benefit, I spent an awful lot of time telling clients not to transact. You know, valuations had really fallen down. There was a fair number of companies that wanted to launch processes or were looking to raise capital. And, you know, I said, look, if you're for sale and if I wanted to buy you, if I want to be a buyer, right, if you want to approach me from that perspective, yeah, I would say yes, right? Because it's a good time to buy. But if you're looking to maximize value in this market, you know, I advise people to wait. And I think that, to toot my own horn, is this kind of, you know, very straightforward, honest, you know, if I were you, this is what I would do kind of approach. Not looking for the short-term transactional benefit. And again, because it's Newbold, my own firm, you know, knock on wood, we've been successful. I honestly don't have, you know, short-term pressure to sort of generate revenue, you know, worry about this year's bonus, that kind of stuff. So it's definitely been a benefit, both from just experiential and you know, the flexibility that having my own firm in Newbold gives me. You know, going to your specific question about FTX, definitely an interesting time, to say the least. I mean, on one sort of very boring level, you know, FTX is a story of just old school fraud, right? The CEO converted customer funds. It's, you know, sort of the classic kind of fraud. And you could argue, you know, any business that takes customer money, whether it's a bank or an investment platform or anything, you see it everywhere. So I don't know if that what he did is anything specific to crypto. I think crypto allowed him to get away with it, you know, to an extent. You know, people clearly didn't do their due diligence.
You mean the frothiness around the environment, the funding environment.
Exactly.
Right.
the frothiness of the market, the sense of FOMO, fear of missing out. Yeah, he sort of seemed to be this schlubby golden boy, for lack of a better word. And so there was definitely some, you know, sort of sector oddities that, you know, I think in a different time in a different market, he, you know, people would have looked more closely and maybe said, you know, what's going on here in terms of, you know, the fund flows between these sort of affiliated entities when they shouldn't have been, you know, converting customer assets from FTX to Alameda. I mean, going forward, you know, I think, you know, definitely the bloom's off some of the rose on crypto. I don't think it's going to go away. I think blockchain, I'm much more of a believer in blockchain as an enterprise solution. You know, I take advantage of doing early stage investments with a group here in New York, which I have to give a plug for, called Tribeca Early Stage Partners, and do a little bit, although very little bit, on my own. And I'm an investor in a company called Earn DLT, which is basically using, you know, crypto enterprise, you know, crypto backbone technology to make illiquid assets a little bit more tradable and trackable. So I think, you know, those kind of applications, you know, crypto's not going to go away. It can solve a lot of problems. But I think you're going to see a real shaking out of the market. The last thing I'd say on this is, you know, the SEC, a lot of people want to criticize the regulators. I would argue in the trading world, you know, going back to that early experience I said to you about why I went into early stage of changes in trading and how back at Lehman, I thought that was fascinating. The SEC has very much had a hands-off attitude towards technology. You know, I think that they've never wanted to pick winners. They've never wanted to pick, if you look at the proliferation of trading venues on the equity side, right? When you and I were, when I was a young man, there was NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange, pretty much it. We had an explosion of these things called ATSs. There's been some consolidation of them. The SEC always said, look, we're going to set the rules. We're going to let you guys beat each other up in the marketplace. And, you know, I think they're going to be probably forced to take a more regulatory aggressive stance on crypto. But I think you see them very much as saying, we're not going to dictate technology solutions. We do want to protect investors. And I think, you know, the view that, you know, these assets are much more securities and fall under the purview of the SEC or one of the US CFTC, I think that's inevitable for things that take place on U.S. soil.
Would you say that more regulation is something that you would say would be a good thing for the industry as a whole?
I believe so, because I think more regulation in terms of creating clarity for providers and for market participants, for traders, investors, those kind of things, because it just sets the guardrails. Like, this is the rules of the game. And, you know, it's still been a little cloudy or gray or odd. You know, the rules around equities are very clear, right? Your ability to offer equity securities to U.S. domiciled and individuals is incredibly constrained. Whereas the extent to which crypto assets are being offered by, you know, non-U.S. domiciled entities, you know, FTX was, you know, based offshore, it seems to happen to a level that if they were offering equities, the SEC or the CFTC in the case of commodities or their instruments would come down like a ton of bricks. I think it shows that the regulators are maybe being too cautious. But again, I don't think the tendency in my experience in the U.S. regulators is they don't want to accidentally squash technological innovation and development. But I think it's going to come, and I think it will create that clarity as to what you have to do to appeal to U.S. participants, whether they be traders or investors or counterparties or whatever. So I think it'll be good.
It'll be fascinating to watch for sure. Matthew, we're almost 3 years in to Newbold's life as a boutique investment bank. And I thought it'd be fun to just kind of look back and reflect a little bit and kind of get your observations over big accomplishments that you'd like to plug, or, you know, even just a reflection on, you know, what might have surprised you about this journey in growing and scaling the platform that you weren't expecting when you initially took that leap.
Yeah, I'd say it's been easier than I thought it was going to be really honest. And yeah, that's a nice surprise. So I'd say to other people who are thinking of going out on their own, you know, have a sober look at yourself in the mirror and think about your client relationships. So you have real relationships it has to be statistically relevant, right? This is a business where you need, you know, a large number of clients because they're not all going to transact. Some may not transact in your professional life. But if you really have good client relationships, they will probably support you wherever you go as long as you're, you know, going to a firm or going to a platform that makes sense. So that, I have to say, was really a pleasant surprise. I thought it was going to be a lot harder. The other thing that's been a pleasant surprise is, you know, this sort of what I call it, you know, this hybrid merchant banking model, which I didn't even think about when I launched Newbold. This idea of, you know, where the opportunity allows to take, you know, half the fees in equity to potentially raise capital alongside clients. It's, you know, frankly, on one point, it's much more lucrative, right? If you believe in the investments, the back-end economics are pretty nice. It also changes that client relationship you'd mentioned before, trust. You know, if you tell a client, hey, I so believe in this deal, I want to have some of the equity, or I'm bringing you a deal where I want to take most of my economics in equity. It really changes that, the dynamic of discussing about how to go after the opportunity and what to do, you know, and who to work with. And so that's been also a pleasant surprise. And I guess the thing I'm proudest of is, you know, I mentioned this before, this sort of call it nearly $1 billion transaction. It's a very attractive asset. I had a very good relationship with the CEO. I knew the owner wanted to transact. And, you know, that was called a feather in my cap. And also on a point about you're talking about trust, it was important to come to the company and sort of do what you said. And so speaking with my client, you know, look, they wrote the vast, but, you know, they were the ones who put most of the money up. I'm playing that role of a advisor to them. You know, when they met with the owner of the asset, we talked, we had, you know, long conversations about this, you know, when they were going to make the formal approach and what the kind of offer they were going to give. And the thing we talked long about was it was critical that they stuck to what they said they were going to do. And to their, you know, unlimited credit, they did exactly that. You know, they did what they were said they were going to do in terms of time, in terms of value, in terms of how they're going to treat management. And the former owner, who no longer is an owner, he was very, very pleased with the whole process. And that reflected, you know, greatly on my client, and immodestly it reflected, you know, not so badly on myself as well. So, you know, that's sort of looking back over those 3 years. It's been, you know, those three things. It's been strangely easier than I thought it was going to be. You know, the big development was something I hadn't even thought about when I launched it. And then getting a transaction off that sort of had those characteristics. You know, those would be the three things that really stick in my mind.
Any exciting plans for Newbold up ahead here in 2023 that you'd like to share?
Yeah, more of the same. You know, we're working on a couple of very large transactions. And so it's really trying to build upon the success to date. You know, probably going to, you know, have to hire a little bit, which is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, increase the scale of the operation.
Well, Matthew, speaking for myself as well as Finalis, we've been absolutely honored here to have the opportunity to partner alongside you and Newbold for close to a couple of years now. And very much look forward to the opportunity to build upon this partnership in the days ahead. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Pencils Down podcast.
No, thanks so much. And likewise, you guys have been a great platform, great partners, you know, over these last, call it, nearly 2 years. The tools you guys have brought to the table have also been incredibly useful, to the point about talking about a virtual experience, right? You and I, we've met in person more than once when you've been in New York. But this is, you know, utilizing virtual tools. You support me and a lot of other independent advisors all over the country.
No, thank you so much for that. And look forward to continuing the conversation sometime soon.
All right. Ben, thanks so much. Best to you and the whole team.
Thank you.
Finalis is a broker-dealer platform with everything that M&A advisors, investment bankers, and placement agents need to succeed. We deliver a broker-in-a-box regulatory affiliation solution, replete with tech-enabled compliance, research and analytics, deal lifecycle management tools, and a first-of-its-kind deal marketplace. Learn more at www.finalis.com. You've been listening to Pencils Down, a Finalis podcast. Keep connected with us by subscribing to the show on your favorite podcast player. If you like what you've heard, please rate the show. That helps us keep covering the latest in the private securities brokerage landscape. Thanks for listening. Until next time.